Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for tuning into The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. Today we talk fuel for fire and the ongoing efforts to reduce our wildfire risk. Did you know the first celebration of Earth Day was back in 1970? It was meant to put environmental issues in the national spotlight, and today we consider what washes up on our shores. We learn from an expert in trust about why we put our faith in sources that perhaps we shouldn't. Think social media and now AI. We hear the call of a now extinct forest bird from Kauai on this week's Mono Minute, the last species of Hawaiian honey eater. And a lawsuit filed over environmental impacts gets heard this week. We take a closer look at plans to expand a resort on Oahu's North Shore. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The recent rainstorms have certainly greened our landscapes across the state, but the grasses, the shrubbery and trees also turned to fuel for fires made worse with high winds. That was a hard lesson we learned from the Maui wildfires. And here to talk about reducing that wildfire risk is HPR's Savannah Harriman-Pote, who covers climate issues for us. Good morning, Savannah.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, you know, I mean, everything looks beautiful. Diamond Head looks fabulous, you know, but we know that there's a downside to that as well.
Yeah, it was interesting. I was speaking to different climate scientists in the middle of the storms and floods to kind of understand these torrential rains that we were getting and the impact that we might see. And already in the middle of these storms, scientists were thinking about how this would affect another hazard, and that's wildfire.
So, you know, talk about, why we need to be paying attention to this.
Well, it's kind of counterintuitive, but these heavy rainfall events, as you say, that cause flooding, cause all of this vegetation growth. And it's incredibly green right now, but really in just a couple of weeks, we could start to see that vegetation dry out if we shift to drier conditions. And so when that happens, it's a process called curing. The landscape becomes full of these potential fuels for wildfire. I spoke about this with Clay Trauernet. He's a fire scientist at the University of Hawaii. And he said if that vegetation isn't addressed, we are going to see a higher risk of wildfires this summer. And he says we need to be strategic about when we tackle this issue.
You do have lead time because it's not like it's going to dry out tomorrow. Fortunately for us, the curing time is definitely a little bit slower than the response as far as how quickly it can grow. But that can also be quick, right? So you're probably talking within weeks that you're getting into the space that these fuels can carry fire. So if all of a sudden the rain just turns off, you know, you'd be looking at within the month, you'd be wanting to look at managing fuels.
So what's the state doing about it?
So I talked to Elizabeth Pickett. She's one of the directors of the Hawaii Wildfire Management Organization, which is really positioned in the middle of all this work. And she said, you know, for a long time, resources to do any kind of vegetation management work were really scarce. But she thinks that's changing. So in the last couple of years, she's seen the tides turn as we get a greater collective understanding of the risk of brush fire and how it relates to these unmanaged fuels. So just last year, the Department of Land and Natural Resources started this new program that offered $1.5 million in grant funding to shovel-ready, community-led vegetation management projects. And Pickett said that this program is really the first of its kind in the state.
Until 2025, we never had any state money toward that. Everyone in Hawaii was competing against each other and the rest of the country for very limited federal dollars to put toward that work. We have a lot of folks who are land rich and cash poor. We have a lot of communities who are willing and wanting to do vegetation management and risk reduction work. But the limiting factor has always been funding and capacity.
So how many projects are we talking about?
So The $1.5 million was divided among eight different projects that got fully funded, and then one was partially funded. And eight of those projects were specifically for reducing hazardous fuels on their landscapes around vulnerable communities. And the funding allowed them to treat about 12,000 acres. And then one awardee also received funds to develop a wildfire mitigation plan. But something that Pickett pointed out was that there were 22 applicants. And I asked, okay, did we only fund nine applicants because those were the ones that met the criteria? And she said, no, if the state had a bigger pool of money, they would have awarded funds to more projects. So that's an example of how the need for resources to do this work is still outstripping the resources that are readily available.
So of these groups, I mean, I don't know, were any of the counties, do they apply?
So these were specifically community-led groups. There is county-level work that is happening on this. The Department of Transportation at the state level is also doing a lot of work on fire mitigation, cutting fuel breaks. The utilities are spending more. We are seeing more money go towards this, but we don't know what exactly the ceiling is on how much we could spend on this issue. Like if we were to try to comprehensively tackle vegetation management across the state, what would it cost? That's like the $1 million, potentially $1 billion question, right? The state has an estimated 1 million acres of unmanaged grasslands. And so if we were to assign one of those like giant checks for vegetation management, how much would it cost? And Elizabeth Pickett says, like, this is the question that she gets asked all the time, especially in the aftermath of the Maui wildfires. And she says, unfortunately, there just is not a straightforward answer. There isn't one big number, you know, we can write down and take to the bank. And part of that is because when you dig into vegetation management strategies, they really, really differ on where they're being applied.
We don't even have a per acre cost that translates from like North Kohala to South Kohala to Maui or to Lahaina to Kahikinui. Like every area's landscape is so different that it's hard to ballpark even what the same treatment would cost, because how steep it is, what is the terrain like, what kind of vegetation is there, is it just grass or is it grass and halicoa? If it's halicoa, it's really hard to get rid of. You need machinery to get the roots out. If not, you have to cut it. You have to inject it so it doesn't come back. And then you have to clear all those seed pods out. So it really depends on each site.
Yeah, so the price tag could vary.
Definitely. And Elizabeth Pickett, she did suggest that I reach out to a working group that is trying to tackle this issue. And so it has experts across the University of Hawaii system, as well as the Hawaii Wildfire Management Organization. And I spoke with three of their experts yesterday, Leah Bremer, Sarah Gabrielson, and Kimberly Burnett. And they said what they're trying to do is create a menu of options for the associated costs of vegetation management for policy managers and land managers, so they can decide how to spend finite resources. Because after the Maui fires, these experts in their field were getting questions from mainly legislatures saying, you know, what can I do? How much does it cost? Is there like a table where I can compare all of these strategies? And that didn't exist at the time, right? So they're trying to create essentially that. And Leah Bremer told me that the menu will include like typical vegetation management strategies like mowing grass, but they're also looking at investments in land use like native forestry and agricultural production and watershed restoration, all of which have fire reduction as a benefit, even if that's not the sole focus of the work. And these strategies are likely going to require more investment up front, but they may net out in the long term with more conventional vegetation management tactics. Because the thing about mowing is that it like requires constant maintenance. You have to do it again and again and again. So rather than spending $1 million every year to cut the grass back, could you instead spend $10 million up front to turn that land into active pastures or native forest or garden plots? Might that make sense instead?
Yeah, and you know, I know they've also talked about using like artificial turf in particularly problemsome areas like near the airports or, you know, in areas where, you know, they want to keep the visibility sight lines open. But yeah, so this group then, you know, they're compiling a report for our lawmakers?
Yes, so they're hoping that by the end of the year, their analysis is going to be ongoing, but they'll be able to get what they call like ranges for what comparative investments might be. And they're also trying to prioritize places that are particularly vulnerable to wildfire, so places where the value of what we might lose, you know, our communities is really high as well, so that we can prioritize resources where they need to go to make the biggest impact.
Yeah, and yeah, the dry season, it was coming soon. But thanks
right
so
around
much.
The corner.
Yes, thanks so much, Savannah.
Thanks, Catherine.
Well, we've been hearing from Savannah Harriman-Pote, who covers climate issues for HPR. You can read her story online at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits committed to helping families of agricultural workers and retirees with affordable housing, such as the Kunia Village Development Corporation. NareitHawaii.com.
Does your significant other make you feel like you're important to them?
He just didn't text me like often enough or kind of speedily enough. And I realized later, it just the lack of texting, that lack of responsiveness did not make me feel loved.
The distinction between being loved and feeling loved. This week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
Support for HPR comes from Ruby Tuesday Hawaii, with locations in Moanalua and Kaneohe, offering dine-in and takeout daily and catering available for business meetings and events. RubyTuesdayHawaii.com.
Today happens to be Earth Day, and in a nod to the environment, we turn our attention to marine debris. Hawaii Business Magazine has a story about that. Ken Wills joins us today. Good morning.
Good morning.
Happy Earth Day.
Thank you.
Well, you know, your headline about trash on Hawaii's beaches telling a global story, I mean, that says it all.
Yeah, you think of Hawaii as a pristine, idyllic place out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and you think there's no chance that pollution will be affecting the islands the way it does. And actually, every day, tons of plastic garbage and other things float up on our shores. And I was surprised to see how much of this actually arrives here. There's a floating garbage patch between Hawaii and California coast, and it floats around in a cycle with the ocean currents. And when it gets close to Hawaii, it sheds off particles. And what happens is that most of it turns out, is fishing nets and fishing gear.
And your story highlights the work that Hawaii Pacific University is doing, right, with trying to track who owns all this stuff.
Well, Hawaii Pacific University's Center for Marine Debris Research, led by Jennifer Lynch, they have a small team, about 12 people total, and they started receiving collected debris and analyzing it. So there are groups on each of the islands that help collect plastics and nets and all kinds of things that land on our beaches. They deliver much of it. 200 tons a year go to the center. And they start pulling through the pieces and figure out what is it and where did it come from. So through their analysis, both chemical analysis and then looking at codes and brand names, they trace it all back to, or not all of it, about 80% of it, they can trace back to fishing, global fishing fleets out in the Pacific. Many of them are Asian, from Asian countries. 60,000 ships are registered in China. That's the largest source. Vietnam is next with 15,000. The U.S. has about 2,000 registered fleets. But most of this is floating across the ocean for years. And there are trawling nets, there are floating devices, there are little pieces of eel traps millions of them get tossed into the ocean as though it was going to disappear. But what happens is it floats across the ocean, takes many years sometimes, gets to be part of this big blob out in the Great Pacific garbage patch, and then some of it ends up on our shores. And so it's really a global story that we're receiving much of this debris.
It's fascinating because I know all this marine debris is turning up in the deepest depths in the Pacific, you know, at the bottom of the Marianas Trench. The first Micronesian scientist went down there and was just appalled. It's making its way down there. And the fact that we have so much of it on our beaches, and you can see the tiny microplastics, right, just accumulating along the shoreline.
Right. And so we hear that some of these plastic things break up over time. They don't disappear. They become small particles. And many fish, many forms of marine life consume those, and that they become part of the food chain. So this plastic doesn't ever really go away. It just breaks down into smaller pieces. We have huge nets and other things that wash up on our shores, and they're collecting other things as they go. Some of them snag on the coral and rip up the bottoms. They bulldoze the bottoms of the ocean as they get close to reefs and islands like ours, and they just do a lot of damage to the islands even before they land on the beaches, and it becomes unsightly. But it's a very big problem. The center, under Jennifer's leadership, Jennifer Lynn, she has gone to some of the countries and fishing fleets in the Asian countries to try to make them aware of the problem, and then to try to turn off the flow, to try to get them to change practices so that nets are not being discarded or caught on the bottom and dragged across the oceans, and floats aren't tossed into the ocean, and these eel trap covers aren't tossed in. So that's a long process on getting other countries to do something about stopping the flow.
It's a good thing that we've begun to do this sleuthing to find out where it's being sourced and taking those steps to try and stop it.
Yeah, and they're also trying to take some of the plastic and turn it into recycled goods. So it's an interesting thing. You can make an ingredient that's used in asphalt. They did an experiment in Eva Beach on the roads. They can make plastic boards for construction and tiles and all kinds of things. And there's another company they're working with that's trying to make plastic trinkets to replace those trinkets that are plastic that are purchased from China and other places from original plastic. So they want to get some of this off the beaches into other forms that can be used.
Right, reusing. Well, it's a fascinating subject and appropriate that we are taking a closer look as we celebrate Mother Earth. But thank you so much, Ken.
Thank you, Catherine.
We've been talking to Ken Wills with Hawaii Business. Look for his story in the May issue of Hawaii Business Magazine. Tune to the conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. It's a birthday and Earth Day quiz this week. Double whammy. If you were listening to the beginning of our show today, you may have recognized the expert string picking of Gabby Pahinui in our first music break. Born April 22, 1921, Philip Kunia Pahinui was a master Hawaiian slotkey guitarist and singer of Hawaiian music. Born into poverty, Pahinui would dive into the waters around Kaka'ako for coins thrown by passengers of passing ships. They said his hair was so kinky, water would roll right off of it, causing his friends to call him Gabardine Hair, and then finally Just Gabby. But it's Pahinui's second album that ties us to Earth Day. The title of his sophomore release refers to a specific islet on the windward side of Oahu, one that's vital to our seabird population. Indeed, you can even spot sooty terns on the album art for the album. For today's quiz, can you tell us the Hawaiian name of this island? Call 808-941-3689 or toll free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag from HPR.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for families of agricultural workers and retirees, such as the Kunia Village Development Corporation. NereidHawaii.com.
A mysterious condition makes people intoxicated, even if they haven't consumed any alcohol.
Sudden loss of coordination, slurring his words, and sure enough, his alcohol level was elevated. And we hadn't even considered alcohol.
I'm Deborah Becker, the medical and legal implications of auto brewery syndrome. That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for HPR comes from the Academy for Healthcare Innovation, offering a hands-on program that teaches the skills needed to be certified in a healthcare role. Learn more at ahihawaii.org.
What makes people trust sources that maybe they shouldn't? That's the question that an expert in AI and misinformation has been studying for years. Shom Sundar is the co-director of the Media Effects Research Lab at Penn State University. He was in town recently to give a talk at the University of Hawaii. Sundar dropped by our studios to talk about his research with the Conversation's Mati Bender. He starts off with what got him interested in studying trust.
Well, at a very basic level, communication is all about trusting the person from whom you're getting the message from, right? So the receiver has to trust the source in order to have any kind of faith in the message that the source is sending. And so in the media world, we call this credibility, source credibility. And so historically speaking, a lot of the messages have strong impact on receivers if it comes from a credible source. Increasingly, as you know, with the internet, especially around the turn of the century, there's been a lot of murkiness around who or what the source is. Sometimes we get news that is sort of secondhand or thirdhand or fourthhand. You know, you might get somebody posting something on your social media feed. It's posted by your friend. Is your friend the source? But your friend got that from some tweet that he or she saw. And so it's very important to determine trust levels of these various sources around us so that we know why people are believing some of the things that they are hearing and seeing on the internet and other, you know, forms of media.
But we're still putting that unfounded trust into it.
Right.
So really talk about, I mean, what makes people put their trust where they shouldn't, whether it's generative AI or even before that, social media and these internet aggregators, et cetera.
The real, you know, kind of core reason behind this is information overload. So when we are overloaded with information, which is the case as media technologies advance, we are having to economize on our cognitive resources, on our mental resources. And so as a result, we are all sort of cognitive misers, and we are not going to do the due diligence in checking out all the information and sources and so forth. So we are going to go by what strikes to us on the face of it as being truthful. And this is what we call cognitive heuristics or mental shortcuts. And so, for example, if there's a person in a white lab coat saying something about a medical or health issue, you immediately believe them to be an authority figure. So we call that the authority heuristic. or when you see a product on Amazon that's got 5 stars and, you know, have a lot of positive ratings, even though it's not by any kind of expert, it's by peers or other shoppers, you tend to have faith in this. This is what we call the bandwagon heuristic, which is the idea that the whole bandwagon is behind this product, so I should also like it kind of thing. And like that, we have these days a machine heuristic. You know, we think of machines as being objective, accurate, unbiased, secure, cannot gossip behind your back and so forth. And so we trust machines, things that a machine produces as being the highest information quality. And so we have all these different heuristics or mental shortcuts through which we judge in an instant whether something should be trusted or something should not be trusted. And if something looks like snake oil salesman, you know, something that it looks shady, we of course distrust it completely. Sometimes that actually turns out to be good information. So there's also, just as we have an over-trust problem, we also have an under-trust problem many times. So the real key is to find that sweet spot that we call appropriate trust, or help people calibrate their trust to the right amount. They should not over-trust or under-trust, but trust about the right level. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So there, at the same time, there's information overload, and then everything is trying to fight for our attention.
Exactly.
To pass our thresholds so that we trust it as an authoritative source.
Yeah.
Add to that mix the rise of the news desert, right? That there are places all over the country and here in Hawaii too, where there are fewer media organizations. How does that change the equation?
Well, I think this makes it very likely that all kinds of unvetted, unverified information will float around much more freely because there are no general interest intermediaries. That's what we call these news organizations. These are basically staffed by people who have training in the art and craft of journalism. And so reporters, especially local news reporters, know how to vet facts, how to double check. You always get 2 sources to verify something, right? So these are basics of journalism that most people don't stop to think that my friend who posted something on Nextdoor or on Facebook has had that. So you don't stop to think that my friend is not trained in journalism, doesn't know better. Instead, you just go with what they post on your feed and you kind of say, you know, I heard this, and, you know, you kind of go from there. And so it makes it very possible for people to get non-verified and, in fact, non-verifiable information in news deserts, because all they're getting is from these ad hoc, untrained local sources or your neighbors and other people who have that kind of sense of authenticity because they are locals just like you, but in fact do not have the professional wherewithal to be able to adjudicate between what should go on the news and what should not. Instead, they just, without filter, post stuff, and it'll create all kinds of bubbles of fake news and misinformation. And some of it, of course, becomes very viral.
Do you have any sense of solutions of, I don't know, places that might be a news desert have figured out ways to increase trust and to tamp down some of the misinformation that locals might be getting?
Yeah, I mean, I think in many ways, the onus resides a lot on the receivers of information. And so to the extent we are able to publicly debunk a lot of the information, false information that comes about, I think that would be the real role of a watchdog or any kind of nonprofit group that can remedy the situation so that the end user can see the value of news organizations that are professional compared to these ad hoc sources from which they get news. And so I think constant exposure of the fallibility of these informal news sources is going to make them much more cautious about believing them in the long run. And also, I think more and more these platforms through which people get news, people need to take action rather than just go with what is visible. So, for example, if you use ChatGPT, you use Gemini, for example, on Google, it'll give you a button that says verify this on Google search engine. So, in other words, people have to take that action to hit that verify button. The ChatGPT is not hallucinating something. They can actually verify it in a search engine, which is from the same parent company, Google. And so these kinds of mechanisms are coming up slowly, where the onus becomes onus is on the user to then take some action. But of course, that means that they have to pause. They cannot be so miserly with their cognitive resources, and they need to be concerned about it. But to raise that concern in the first place, you need to have a vast debunking campaign that would say, what's the problem with all this social media and other informal sources through which you're getting information?
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of work. And I know that there's been legislation at the state and even federal levels, but the folks I've talked to at least say that this current federal administration isn't super keen on, you know, restricting social media, restricting the AI companies. So at the moment, it's really left up to the consumer of the information.
Yeah. And in some ways, they can also litigate, right? Like in the recent famous cases with the social media, you know, leading to, you know, mental health and other issues, and the LA case that Meta and YouTube got into, or, you know, the ruling was against them because they were designing their algorithms such that it permits infinite scrolling so that people cannot stop, they cannot put down their phones or stop using the platform. And so to the extent we can, you know, have consumers rise up to this this kind of an algorithmic force, if you will, I think, you know, we can get the platforms to have more proactive measures whereby they ask the users to verify this. You know, they can have a message that says this person shared this link without even reading it. You know, there's one of our studies last year showed that 75% of the things that people share on Facebook, they don't read it themselves, and they share it without reading. And so it's very easy for the platform to say that this person shared it without even clicking on the link themselves. Those kinds of alerts eventually will make people much more, I think, aware of some of the problems with relying on these sort of online equivalent, what we would call hearsay or electronic word of mouth, if you will.
One question I had for you, as someone who researches this space, is there something that individuals do that as a researcher, you're just like, oh my gosh, I wish I could change that behavior. I wish they wouldn't like trust that easily or can do this thing when it comes to how they consume media, how they experience the internet.
Yeah, I told you my pet peeve with my undergraduates is getting news off of the phone and thinking it's coming from the phone company. But along the same lines these days with AI, a lot of people rely on AI summary. And so AI summarizes news or whatever it is. Like if you go to a search engine even, it actually gives you an AI summary. And there's been just in the last 8 to 10 months since it's been there, there's a 62% drop in the number of people who are clicking through the search links. And so that's a dramatic decrease for companies like Google, which depends heavily on advertising, for them to have that kind of loss and click through, because the AI summary is all people are picking up and running with it. So for me, that's really scary because that's not the search engine part. That is just a summarizing service that sits on top of a search engine and can easily be misled. I've had several cases of my students getting the wrong idea about a reading that they're supposed to do for class based on what they thought was an AI summary or an accurate AI summary of that, when in fact it's not. Or they engage with the AI like ChatGPT in a chat about a particular reading that they assigned them, and they think that just because they had that conversation, it's like exactly what this article is about. But in fact, it just conversation takes its own turn and goes off in a different direction than what the reading's intended purposes. And so I see this all the time as a professor, even among my students do that. I can only imagine all the news consumers out there, how much they might be misled with these so-called AI summaries.
Well, I am definitely going to be more conscious of my own internet habits. But I learned a lot. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me. Yeah, it's been my pleasure.
That was Shyam Sunder and HPR's Maddie Bender talking about trust, AI, and how to have a savvier media diet. We'll have links to learn more on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from Big Island Coffee Roasters, featuring Kona Restoration Farm Coffee and their new Ka'u Mo'aula Lempira, available now at BigIslandCoffeeRoasters.com or their cafe in Hilo.
Tune in to HPR 2 on Sunday at 3 p.m. when the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra presents Beethoven Fest, the first in a series of concerts devoted to the works of Ludwig von Beethoven. In this matinee performance, we'll hear Symphony No. 1 and Symphony No. 3, Eroica. We'll also hear the world premiere of Ye Xiao Gong's original work, also called Eroica. That's Sunday at 3 p.m. on HPR 2, sponsored by the Rice Partnership.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Ruby Tuesday Hawaii.
This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio, and we now go to this week's Manu Minute with University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart, who shares the story of an extinct songbird. This week's Manu Minute was made with recordings from the Cornell Lab of Ornithology.
Like many of our native Hawaiian forest birds, the Kauai o'o is now extinct. A very small population of this species made it into the 1980s in the highest forest near the top of Kauai, when the last known individual was recorded singing its beautiful and haunting song to a mate that no longer existed. The loss of these birds was especially tough because they represent a lineage that had been in Hawaii for millions of years before Kauai even rose out of the ocean. These beautiful birds had rich black plumage with bright yellow tufts of feathers above their legs, which were often important components in the finest Hawaiian featherwork. Kauai o'o fed primarily on nectar of various native flowers, and the causes for their extinction were similar to those for many other native Hawaiian birds, and include habitat destruction and introduced predators and disease. For Hawaii Public Radio, I'm Patrick Hart from the Biology Department at UH Hilo.
Support for Manu Minute comes from the Hawaii Audubon Society, co-hosting the Manu o Ku Festival May 2nd at Iolani Palace, featuring games and activities and open to all in the community. HIAudubon.org.
Now it's time to flock to the answer of today's backyard quiz question. Earlier, we celebrated April 22nd, both Earth Day and the birthday of a legendary local musician, Gabby Pahinui. Pahinui was one of the 20th century masters of Hawaiian vocal, slack key, and steel guitar music, despite not knowing how to read music. As a tie-in to Earth Day, we asked you about the island featured as the backdrop and name of Gabby Pahinui's second album. Rabbit Island Music Festival was released back in 1973, and while most songs were recorded at Sound of Hawaii Recording Studio, both the intro and outro of the album were recorded on the island. Pahinui and his band performed for an audience of protected seabirds, including sooty terns, which are featured on the album cover. We asked you for the Hawaiian name of Rabbit Island, and we were looking for Manana Island, which means buoyant. Fun fact we learned in researching this quiz is that Gabby's son, Cyril Pahinui, celebrates his birthday on April 21st. And congrats to our winner, Kimo Lyman from Mokulea. Mahalo and aloha back at you. That is today's quiz. If you have one you'd like to share, write to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org. A grassroots activist group on Oahu will have its day in court tomorrow. Kupa'a Ku'ilima and Earth Justice filed a lawsuit in state court to block the proposed development of a second resort on the Ritz-Carlton's Turtle Bay property. The groups argue that host hotels and resorts, the owners of the property, are using an outdated environmental impact survey. That EIS was done back in 2013 and may not account for changes to the area, and those include a recent increase in monk seal pupping, albatross nesting, and the discovery of the endangered yellow-face bee, the Nalo Mele Maoli. The Conversation's Kevin Allen recently took a tour of the area with members of Kupa'a Ku'ilima. Here's Lily Makaila, a board member of the organization.
We actually had meetings with representatives of host some time ago as we were being activated with our concerns about the luxury condos. And they invited us to come and have a conversation with them and their PR team. And we shared with them specifically that we're not anti-development per se, but we believe strongly in Pono development. And Pono development looks like thoughtful, mindful, community inclusive types of development where you understand what all the resources are that are here, including our native species, both plants and animals, and our native people. We just explained to them really clearly that we wanted them to do the appropriate amount of studies and updated studies, and that was our biggest concern. So we were super disappointed to see that they are following in the pathway of the luxury condos in just trying to get an exemption and not actually have to do those studies or engage with the community at all.
Can you tell me a little bit more? What are those animals that we are really concerned about and you guys are looking at?
Our monk seals are up here. We have our turtles. We have all of our kind of marine life. And then in this delicate space between the ocean and kind of the land base is what's called the coastal strand habitat. And the coastal strand habitat is a very narrow corridor where there's really beautiful native life, amongst other types of life. But we specifically see in this coastal strand area up here life like our Hawaiian yellow-faced bees, the Nalo Mele Maoli. There are several types of Nalo Mele Maoli that have recently, in 2016, they were identified as an endangered species. So not just a threatened species, but an endangered species. And two of those species are found right here. And where we're standing, we can see the Naupaka. And that's where the coastal strand is. And that's where we'll see a lot of our Nalo Mele Maoli. And so, you know, it may look like just bushes and trees, but it's very important. And most of that area gets, you know, changed or removed during development. You know, the coastal strand over there is very sensitive. And as we started doing research, we found that oftentimes in development, you'll have what's called a shoreline setback, or, you know, you can kind of get an exemption from the shoreline setback that gives you a variance. And we found that the shoreline setback, which identifies the area that's not buildable between the shoreline and the development, was actually decided upon in 1985. And we were pretty alarmed by that because as someone who wasn't born in 1985 yet, I have watched our shorelines change and migrate just in my lifetime. And the thought that the shoreline and the non-buildable area that was identified as a setback for our development is actually, you know, so old. It's older than I am. And so our shores are dynamic, especially up here. And it was really a huge wake-up call to us that, hey, maybe they're not following the right processes. Maybe some of these studies and the variance that they received and just how the county is handling itself may not be in the best interest of the place or the people that are up here. And so we felt compelled to maybe make a little bit more noise. And I think in my under another hat that I wear, my job is actually working for state agency, reviewing environmental disclosure documents and providing comments. And if this had been floated through my desk professionally, I would have had quite a few comments about the age of the technical documents and technical reports that were being utilized. And again, that was even something we expressed to the host hotel folks when we met with them, that our concern was about outdated technical documents. You know, the EIS, or the environmental disclosure document, is in essence a summary of all of those technical studies. Things that look at historic preservation, those are usually pretty standalone, and they can last for a longer period of time. If you're doing like a phase one ESA, which is looking at, are there pollutants or is there any type of remediation that needs to be done? Those can last a little bit longer. But things like a biological study with flora and fauna, that is a very dynamic type of document. And in general, once you get to 5 years, then you kind of want to repeat. Even if it's just a supplemental update, it doesn't mean the information from before isn't valuable. You just want to do a supplement. And the cost-wise and the amount of time is pretty negligible, especially if you're talking about a luxury resort. And so we were just very surprised that there didn't seem to be any efforts to do those or to make them available to the public so that we could have our concerns assuaged.
I think a lot of points have been raised about, well, if there is development here, right, it might make jobs. It would help the economy. You know, a lot of local people here are employed by Turtle Bay Resort. What are kind of your thoughts about that?
Yeah, sure. I think that there's a lot of interest in having more job opportunities where folks don't have to commute as far. I think the concern that we've heard about those job opportunities is that they might be kind of limited, that a lot of the upper management positions or the more skilled positions with a higher pay and a more livable wage actually go to folks who are already in the host hotel or Ritz-Carlton, you know, system. That there's a lot of folks who work here that come in from out of state and live in the hotel for some time, or, you know, end up living in our communities. But it's more of a transient population. They kind of come and go. There are a lot of folks who've worked here generationally from the community. And, you know, most of us have had access to this space because of our familial ties, not just to this area, but also to the hotel. And you can't not say that the hotel isn't beautiful or that it's a gorgeous place to visit. I think our concern is, how many do you need? The Ritz-Carlton Hotel is gorgeous and it employs a lot of people that are over there. But, you know, like, how many people would actually be employed by another luxury hotel? And this isn't the only additional hotel that's being proposed. There's a third one that's also being proposed. And so, yeah, we just have those types of concerns that maybe it's not what it's being pitched to the community.
So kind of coming back from this lawsuit perspective, what are you guys hoping to achieve with all of this effort?
I think we would really appreciate it if Department of Planning and Permitting would do an internal review at their processes. We actually sat down and had a conversation with them, as well as the managing director for the mayor, as well as our representative out in this area, Matt Wire, who made it possible for us to sit with them last year. We just explained our concerns, and they explained to us that they had already approved it and they're just following their processes. And, you know, we expressed, well, what about the endangered species that were added to the endangered species list in 2016? And they said, well, there's no expiration on environmental impact statement. And so technically they feel like they're following the rules. And we are now questioning whether those rules are appropriate. So I think our main hope for this is to make the types of procedures and processes for building in very beautiful, very, very important places to us, both culturally and community, to our community, more clear and more reflective of what the community desires. I think most people would like to have basic foundational studies that account for the native plants, animals, and native practices that take place in a certain area. And of course, would also include Iwikupuna or other graves or burials that are in that site. I just couldn't imagine building something without understanding the area where I'm planning to build. And I don't know how you could even get so far as to design and construction when you don't actually fully understand all of the resources that are there. That's our hope, that this will have impacts both on the proposed development, but also on the county and how they understand their responsibility. We consider them to be have a responsibility to the community and the people of Hawaii. And so the fact that, you know, their work has direct impacts on us, we would like them to better account for, you know, what the community is concerned about.
That was Lily Maka'ilo with the grassroots activist group Kupa'a Ku'ilima. We did reach out to Host Hotels and Resorts for comment. They said in part, while we cannot comment on ongoing litigation, Host believes it has acted in compliance with all applicable laws, permits, and established agreements governing the property. The current proposed development has been significantly reduced through conservation easements, settlement agreements, and adopted community plans from previously approved plans for this area. Our focus remains on environmental stewardship, public shoreline access, and continued community engagement while we work through the legal process. A hearing is set for tomorrow at 10 a.m. We have to go, but tomorrow we follow the thread of AI in the islands. So we talk to the president of Mid-Pacific Institute, highlighting the promise of AI in education. Got a story you'd like to share? Leave your feedback on our talkback line, 808-792-8217. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.